This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Biographies and Memoirs. Learn the life stories of your favorite contemporary and historical figures and the struggles and victories that made them who they are. World leaders, scientific innovators, creative minds, and celebrities inspire our own lives with their stories. It's Biographies and Memoirs, now on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Biographies and Memoirs, and I'm your reader, Margaret Ankenbrook, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the book Be Ready When the Luck Happens, a memoir by Ina Garten. Copyright 2024 by Ina Garten. And now I'll continue reading in the chapter entitled Tokyo, How Hard Could That Be? I was as serious about business issues as I was about cooking. Pricing at Barefoot Contessa was never a whimsical decision. It was a mathematical formula based on the price of ingredients and the cost of labor. In the early days of computers, I had the idea of hiring a programmer at New York University to design a basic program for me so I could input the cost of bulk ingredients and figure out the cost of an item. I started with the ingredients for my brownies: flour, sugar, butter, eggs, vanilla, chocolate chips, walnuts, and when I was finished, the computer told me each one should sell for $2.50 at a time when the average brownie cost about 75 cents. Oops! I adjusted a few ingredients and was able to get the price down to $2.25, which was still insane. Absolutely no one is going to buy this, I thought. There was only one way to find out. I baked a tray of brownies and put them out to see what would happen. They were gone in 5 minutes. So I baked more and more. I think I made something like 1,600 brownies that weekend, and every single one sold. It was a good lesson. If you make something with the best ingredients and it's as delicious as it looks, people don't care what it costs because it's worth it. A 75-cent brownie tastes like a 75-cent brownie. Our customers wanted the best brownie, and they were willing to pay for it, which gave me a lot of freedom to be creative. Which brings me to the story about the duck. A woman came into the store to pick up a roast duck she'd ordered. The man standing next to her eyed that duck like it was his next wife, the only thing he'd ever wanted. He told the salesperson that he'd like a roast duck, too, and was not happy to hear that it was a special order and he could come back in 2 hours and pick it up. It was the 80s. Greed was good. This master of the universe turned to the woman and offered to buy her duck. She laughed at first, then saw that he was dead serious. "How much for the duck?" he pressed, clearly not taking no for an answer. The woman grabbed her duck and escaped to the cash register to pay for it. He followed her to the register and then out the door, down the alley, to the parking lot, the whole way upping his offer. "This is my final offer," he shouted. $100 for your duck." We heard as she got into her car and drove away. He was a Wall Street trader type of guy. He didn't understand how she could have paid $15 for a roast duck and 5 minutes later would turn down $100. Think of the return on her investment. Of course, she saw that duck as dinner and couldn't have cared less for the ROI. Meanwhile, he was so intent on getting her duck that he didn't order his own. That would have been too easy. The funny thing is that whenever I tell this story, half the people actually can't understand why she didn't take the money. It wasn't unusual for the cooking staff to work late hours, and I always tried to keep everybody's spirits up during those grueling baking marathons. "Okay," I said conspiratorially very late one night, trying to make it a game, "let's each tell the worst thing we've ever done." Well, that turned out to be a really bad idea. I expected the usual stories about a wild party or a dangerous prank, but when it was the cook's turn, she confided, "I used to steal." I was shocked. Steal what? Defined used to. Was this a confession or a heads up? Absolutely a heads up. Not long after she alerted me, I caught her red-handed and had to fire her. Why was I surprised when she had just told me who she was? People don't stop doing things like that. Moving forward, I tried to be more careful with my hires, and I also thought twice about playing truth games. I have often thought that everybody should work in retail at some point in their lives, kind of like mandatory military service. They would understand two things. First, that serving customers all day can be a very difficult job, and second, that being kind is so much more effective than being nasty. Every summer ended with a blowout party for the staff. They had worked so hard and done an amazing job, and I wanted to show them how much I appreciated it. Well, maybe also because it was so much fun. The first year, the dress code was creative black tie with a menu of filet of beef and champagne. Notably, the drinking age was 18 then. I added a Groucho Marx mustache to my outfit just to lighten things up. The next summer, we went wild with a MASH theme and an operating tent in the middle of the store. Hunt dressed up as a helicopter, complete with a propeller on his head, and someone dressed up as a patient wrapped in bloody bandages. I borrowed my father's operating room scrubs and came as a surgeon. But the party that stands out was the Barefoot Olympics. Sarah carried the torch, a flaming duck on a stick, while sitting on the hood of a car racing across a field at night, which seemed like a good idea at the time. That was for the opening ceremony, and each game had something to do with food, like the bagel toss, blindfolded name that substance, think pickled herring, and baguette javelin throwing. We worked hard and we played hard, and there are a few stories I'm happy that I don't remember. One involving my employees dragging me out of someone's swimming pool at 3 a.m. No, we didn't have their permission when the police showed up. I was so wrapped up in the store, some nights we had to push people out the door when we wanted to close, that I almost didn't hear opportunity knocking. During the summer of 1984, I got a call from a man who owned a building on Newtown Lane in East Hampton. Would I be interested in renting a space and opening a specialty food store there? The current tenant, he explained, was Dean and DeLuca, but they were leaving. I had always loved Dean and DeLuca. Whenever I had a day off, I went to East Hampton just to see my dream store. Barefoot Contessa was casual and accessible, which was the perfect vibe for its beachy location, but Dean and DeLuca was more sophisticated, and everything in the store was brilliantly sourced and beautifully displayed. It was the first specialty food store to use metro racks for shelves, and they were stocked with encyclopedic offerings you'd find in an upscale European emporium. 50 different vinegars, 150 varieties of mustard. It was like a museum. No, it was heaven. God, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a store like this, I thought as I walked through the stunning assortment of food. Given how I felt, I should have been thrilled by the offer, but I was already shaking my head. It was hard enough to run one store. A second store? No way. Thank you very much, but I'm just not interested, I told him. When I mentioned the conversation to Jeffrey, he had a different reaction. Think of it this way, he suggested. For the price of $15 a square foot, you could have your own Dean and DeLuca, your dream specialty food store, and all their customers, too. He pointed out that people were already used to coming to that space and buying good food. I wouldn't have to build the business. It was already there and successful. I would be taking over Dean and DeLuca free. Suddenly, I saw all the positives, but before I got too carried away, I wanted to make sure Joel Dean, one of the owners of Dean and DeLuca, and a legend in the food business, knew about it. I knew him professionally, and I didn't want him to think that I would just rent his store out from under him. When we talked on the phone, he told me he actually wanted to stay in the space, but he wasn't paying $15 a square foot for the store. He had offered the landlord $14.50 a square foot, and he wasn't going to budge. Really? For 50 cents a square foot, he was willing to walk away from a successful business? That was crazy. I asked what he would do if someone else took over the space, and he said he'd move up the street and open Dean and DeLuca again. Joel, I said, please rent the store if you're happy there. It's not worth losing for 50 cents a square foot. But he'd made up his mind, and I had warned him. I waited 24 hours to let Joel change his mind and then called the landlord. Thank you very much. I'll take the space. 50 cents, that's crazy, I thought. First of all, it costs a fortune to relocate, and the new location would never be as good as the old one. Second, there would now be another specialty food store in town competing with him. And third, it would take a year to move, so people would get out of the habit of going to Dean and DeLuca. I had tried to talk him out of it because it was the right thing to do. But in the end, it was a cautionary tale. I did open Barefoot Contessa in their old space. Dean and DeLuca moved to a terrible location up the street at $23 a square foot, and they never recovered. A few years later, they closed. It was sad, even for me, because I adored Joel Dean's store, but it was a reminder to never dig in your heels on a negotiation, especially if it's just about money. There was another reason I was so excited about opening in East Hampton. As much as I loved West Hampton, it was strictly a summer place. Too much to do in the summer, nothing to do in the winter. That's the nature of a seasonal business, like a clam shack. But the stores in East Hampton never closed. I could have a place that was open all year, staffed by real food store professionals. Barefoot wouldn't feel so temporary, and I wouldn't need to hire and train a whole new staff every spring, which was exhausting. I stopped in to see my friend Anna Pump at Loaves and Fishes so she'd hear it from me first, explaining what I wanted to expand and that it was my dream to have a business that wasn't seasonal. And in case she was worried about proximity, the new place would be just 5 miles from her store. I had a bright idea. Why don't we own the store together? We can be partners. Anna's answer was quick and disappointing. No, she didn't want a second store, so that was that. But are you okay with me doing it? I pressed, expecting her to react positively the way I had when she opened Loaves and Fishes. She really wasn't okay with it. I could see that she was anxious about having competition, especially since we had shared all our recipes and suppliers, and I found myself in a terrible situation, one I'd never faced before. If I pursued my dream, I might be hurting a friend, which is awful. Honestly, I didn't think having another specialty food store in the area would be a problem for either of us. Dean and DeLuca had been there for years, and new places popped up every summer. There were a lot of hungry people in the Hamptons. I had to trust my own instincts, which can be really hard to do when someone you care about is telling you something is a bad idea. Anna's feelings and fears were real to her, and so were the consequences. When I moved ahead with my plan, she stopped speaking to me. I think we both felt the loss of our friendship. I know I did. Flash forward, Anna called me a year or so into our estrangement. I know I was anxious about your being there, but it hasn't changed my business at all, she admitted. What I heard was an invitation to pick up our friendship where we'd left off. We did just that, a little older and a little wiser for the experience. Everything was falling into place, even on the home front, because Jeffrey was negotiating to buy the Southampton Press, a local newspaper, and we were thinking about living together in the Hamptons full-time. The lovely idea got derailed when the owner of the paper decided not to sell and the deal fell through. I felt terrible because Jeffrey was so disappointed, but I felt even worse about what happened next. Lehman Brothers asked Jeffrey to open a branch of the investment bank in Tokyo, and he said yes. Well, wait a minute, I said. How's this going to happen? I just signed a lease for the store in East Hampton, so how are we going to live in Tokyo? It would be inconvenient. No, impossible, and really expensive to travel between New York, the Hamptons, and Tokyo. The reality of our situation and my cold shower response made Jeffrey reconsider, and he immediately went back to Lehman, trying to get out of an offer that he had accepted without making it look like he'd changed his mind. He told his boss that in order for him to take a job like this, he and his wife would need unlimited first-class travel between New York City and Tokyo so we could see each other. Jeffrey figured that would put an end to the problem. No problem, his boss declared. Oh my God, what else could he demand that would get him out of the deal? Full housing and daily expenses paid? No problem. Furniture and art for the new apartment in Tokyo? No problem, his boss said. No matter what Jeffrey asked for, they said yes, so in the end he felt obligated to accept the offer, and I secretly think he was excited about the challenge of opening a bank in Tokyo. Let me make this really simple, his boss suggested. Whatever you need to make this work, unlimited first-class travel for both of you, an apartment in Tokyo, furniture, anything, we'll pay for it. This is where Jeffrey is at his best. What he wanted to do and what I wanted to do were frankly incompatible. But Jeffrey likes to think we can make anything work. Instead of deciding that only one of us would get their dream job, he said, let's try both. I'll work in Tokyo and you'll work in East Hampton for a year. We'll each travel back and forth for 1 week a month. And if at any time it doesn't work, we'll make a change. I was totally game to try, and the best part was that he wasn't prioritizing his big deal investment banking job over my small retail food store job. I made a quick trip to Tokyo in December and found and furnished an apartment in 1 week, which was just insane. Jeffrey hates moving. As a kid, his family moved every year. And I wanted him to feel completely at home, so I recreated the apartment we'd just finished decorating in New York right down to our Le Corbusier dining table as his desk and his favorite Alvar Aalto chair. I even loaded the CD player with the same music we listened to at home. When he was in the apartment, everything he loved would be within reach except me. But we'd already decided to take turns going back and forth once a month. It was only Tokyo, right? How bad could this be? The Pinochle Club. I took over the new store on January 1, 1985, and immediately started renovating. We built a commercial kitchen in the back, then had the good idea of running the exhaust vents out the side of the building so the scent of freshly baked bread perfumed the street, the best advertisement for what was inside. As a finishing touch, I added an old-fashioned screen door to the entrance. The sound of that door slamming shut was the essence of summer, of vacations and carefree times, a signal to relax, indulge, and eat. By now, Sarah had graduated from Yale, so I convinced her to come to East Hampton to run the store with me, and I hired a wonderful group of people. As soon as the renovation was finished, I decided that we would all clean and stock the store together so we could get to know each other and start feeling like a team. With a lot of hard work, we were ready to open in May. I was a little nervous about being accepted by the East Hamptonites, who viewed Dean and DeLuca as a very chic, high-end store, a place New York Magazine described as swelligant elegant, like Soho at the beach. I knew they saw me as that woman with the deli in West Hampton. Who is this person, and why is she in my Dean and DeLuca? The first few weeks, it seemed I couldn't do anything right. The prices were too high. The food was too this or too that. Then there was the rumor that Barefoot Contessa had pushed out Dean and DeLuca, which was untrue, and if anyone bothered to think about it, extremely unrealistic, like a mouse clobbering an elephant. I decided to test the market. I cut the price of the pasta salad in half to see if the customers were really responding to the cost or if they were just annoyed by my replacing Dean and DeLuca. Then I cut it in half again. Guess what? They were just annoyed. No matter what I did, they didn't like it, even when I put samples out for them to taste, something Dean and DeLuca never did. I felt like saying, "It's a food store, lighten up." But they had strong ties to the past and needed time to adjust. I had to remind myself about the enthusiastic customers in West Hampton who couldn't get enough of our food, who lined up at the door before we opened and knocked on the window after we closed, desperate for just one more brownie. Instead, I cranked up the music and smiled. This was my opportunity to make everyone feel that they were invited to my party. We added a dash of cinnamon to our brewed coffee, and the scent was an aphrodisiac. The coconut cupcakes, or frosting delivery systems, as we like to think of them, were like crack, everyone's favorite legal guilty pleasure. No one cared about the calories because they were so good. When customers barreled in on Fridays, still vibrating from the stress of the work week and the tension of the infamous crawl on the Long Island Expressway, we calmed them down. A houseful of very hungry weekend guests arriving any minute, Barefoot had something for every palate, from breakfast muffins and fried chicken to croissants and beef bourguignon. Eventually, we all adjusted, and it was fine. No, it was wonderful. As I'd hoped, strangers became regulars, and when the screen door slammed, I'd look up to see a now familiar face. Frank Newbold, a realtor who worked down the street, popped in every day for a lunchtime sandwich. The beautiful older woman who wore pristine white gloves? That was Esty Lauder. And when she ordered racks of barbecued ribs, we joked that those gloves would have to come off. Customers pretended not to notice when they spotted Steven Spielberg at the counter, but they spent twice as much time browsing and sipping coffee whenever he was in the store. One day I was working at my desk, which was right by the cheese counter, when I heard a very imperious voice telling me, "I'd like a roast beef sandwich on a roll." I looked up, ready to explain that Barefoot didn't make sandwiches to order, when I realized that the voice belonged to the incomparable and slightly terrifying Lauren Bacall. What did I say? "Would you like mustard on that?" How could I? How could anyone say no to Lauren Bacall? I rented a house not far from the East Hampton store and treated it like a crash pad, flopping on the sofa when I had a free minute. This is when my memory gets blurry, because running two stores in separate locations and commuting to Tokyo turned out to be a lot harder than I imagined. I felt that I couldn't be away from the store on weekends, so I'd fly out on a Monday, secretly looking forward to the moment when I could collapse in first class at Lehman Brothers' expense, which was so much better than the living room in my rental house. The 7,000-mile flight was like a little vacation. The phone didn't ring. I didn't have to make any decisions or put out any fires, and I could relax with a drink and a good book and enjoy the quiet. That was the high point of the trip. I'd arrive in Tokyo on Tuesday, vaguely resembling a human being by Wednesday, then leave on Thursday to get home by Friday night. Jeffrey did the same zombie run 2 weeks later when it was his turn. When I got home, it was time to race between East Hampton and West Hampton, no small feat in the summer, when heavy traffic meant the distance was calculated in hours instead of miles. I was such a regular for breakfast at Dave's Bun and Burger that when the payphone rang at 6:30 a.m., I'd jump up from my booth to answer it, certain it was Jeffrey calling from Tokyo. He knew exactly where to find me at that hour. I ate my breakfast, he finished his dinner, and we caught up on the news until it was time for me to go to work. No matter how often I showed up at the West Hampton store, though, it wasn't enough. "You're never here anymore," my old customers complained. Martine, who was managing the store, was doing a great job, but it wasn't the same as having the owner there 24/7. People were used to Mom being home. If I felt at all torn between the two places, I was definitely leaning toward East Hampton, partly because of the wonderful new friends I found there. Antonio Balanca, an insanely talented florist, owned a small jewel box shop on Newton Lane, right near Barefoot Contessa. I loved popping in, and on one visit she introduced me to Frank Newbold, the realtor who bought his lunch at Barefoot every day. "Only a handful of us live here full-time in the winter," Antonia pointed out. "We all have to become good friends." We sort of laughed, but then that's exactly what we did, calling ourselves the Pinochle Club, even though we never once played Pinochle. Our little group expanded to four when Antonia met her future husband. We had such a good time together, going out for dinner just about every night, watching movies, planning parties at the drop of a hat. Suddenly, I had an actual life outside of my work. And Jeffrey loved his assignment in Tokyo. His job was to close a commercial bank for American Express and open an investment bank. When he wasn't working, he wrote for the New York Times and other publications. Our long-distance arrangement was going smoothly. So smoothly that after about a year, I had a terrible thought. I called Jeffrey and said, "I think you need to come home. It's not that I'm miserable. It's just the opposite. I'm perfectly fine, and I think that's really, really dangerous." I was afraid that I was getting used to living without him, and I wasn't willing to let that happen. Jeffrey understood what was at stake and agreed to wrap up his business in Tokyo. He just had to make one quick stop in Hong Kong to visit an important client, then he'd be right home, he promised. One quick stop turned out to be the understatement of all time. When Jeffrey arrived in Hong Kong, his client, one of the biggest shipping companies in the world, was in the middle of the largest and possibly most complicated bankruptcy in history. Jeffrey's specialty in investment banking was restructuring sovereign debt. When a country is in bankruptcy and owes billions in loans it can't pay. But no one had ever restructured a personal debt that size. His client was convinced that Jeffrey was the only person who could do it. The client begged him to stay, booked him a suite at the Mandarin Oriental, and urged him to start that very day. It was a dramatic and exciting project for Jeffrey, one of the most interesting challenges he'd ever faced. I was disappointed because spending another year apart wasn't exactly what I had in mind, but this was his big moment, and I wanted him to be happy. That's the key to a successful relationship, isn't it? Wanting the person you love to be happy, no matter what the cost, and knowing they want the same for you. I traded my 17-hour flight to Tokyo for a 24-hour flight to Hong Kong. Stressful and exhausting? Yes. But we figured it out and got through another year. It occurred to me that this might be a good time to eliminate another source of stress in my life, the store in West Hampton. I'd turned into Where's Waldo, bouncing between the two stores and feeling like I was losing control wherever I landed. I decided to close it and put all my energy into my year-round retail and catering business in East Hampton. It was a difficult decision because I loved my store and felt sentimental about my customers there, but it was the right thing to do. Even with one store, the summers were insane. A routine day often turned into an all-nighter, especially when I'd get the dreaded call at 3 a.m. with the news that the baker wasn't coming in and I had to race to the store to make the baguettes before opening. Literally, 1,000 baguettes. The demands never stopped. I was used to having a break in the winter when the West Hampton store was closed, when I had a few months to leisurely test recipes, explore new vendors, and recharge before the new season started. But the East Hampton store was open all year. Financially, that was a good thing. The winter was busy because people came to the Hamptons for holidays and long weekends. In fact, New Year's Eve was usually our biggest day of the year. We decorated the store with thousands of black, white, and silver balloons and cranked up the music. The staff, dressed like Bob Fosse dancers in white shirts and black pants, bow ties, and bowler hats, served champagne to our happy customers. It felt like a party, and the shopping was insane. People ordered extravagantly. I'll take that big tin of caviar or that whole side of smoked salmon so they could continue the celebration at home. I never had a chance to catch my breath. I was beyond exhausted and maybe a little lost personally. My friend Antonia suggested that I see her therapist, which I did, and it was one of the most important decisions I've ever made. Her name is Cecily Stranahan, and she changed the rest of my life. I can't imagine where I'd be without her extraordinary advice. "I'm just working all the time," I told her. "I'm not having any fun." She asked me what I would consider fun. I'd never asked myself that question, but I thought for a moment. How about a convertible? Because who can be unhappy in a convertible? And a masseuse to get the kinks out. The next day, I rented a bright red 1964 Mustang convertible and booked an appointment for a massage. 39 years later, I'm still driving a convertible and I'm still seeing the same masseuse. Cecily wisely intuited that I was searching for more than ways to have fun. Our weekly conversations during the next 3 years covered territory that was harder to explore. I was pretty unhappy in 1985, but it wasn't just because I was working too hard or missing Jeffrey. With Cecily's help, I asked myself tough questions about the root of my unhappiness and why I had such low self-esteem. I could link my self-doubt to my childhood when I felt unseen and unappreciated. There was a lot to unpack there. But Cecily made me realize that the highly critical voice in my head was actually my parents' voice, not mine. It's really hard to separate yourself from that voice, but I started telling myself, that's what my mother would have said. Everything you've done has come out better than you could have imagined, so listen to your own voice. Cecily helped me to understand that the past wasn't my only problem. How I was dealing with it, or more accurately, not dealing with it, was making me unhappy. There's a wonderful quote attributed to George Lucas. "We're all living in cages with the door wide open." That was me until I realized I had the power and the responsibility to set myself free, to step out of the cage of whatever I'd experienced in the past, to think for myself, and to believe in my choices. There was one legacy that had real consequences. When I was in my 20s, I had no idea why people have children. Because I had such a horrible childhood with my parents, with emotional and sometimes physical abuse, I couldn't understand why anyone would want to recreate that family. I didn't. There's a saying, "What goes in early goes in deep." After my experience, my mind was closed to the possibility of having my own child. My brother Ken felt the same way. The subject of parenting came up when we were having lunch sometime in the 70s. We each said that we didn't want to have children because we were afraid of doing to them what our parents did to us. It was a painful feeling to carry, and it affected our choices in life. Eventually, after I worked on some of my issues in therapy and spent time with friends who had loving, nurturing relationships with their children, I understood that it didn't have to be that way. But Jeffrey and I were content with our choices and our life. When Dolly Parton opened up to Oprah Winfrey about why she didn't have children, she said, "If I hadn't had the freedom to work, I wouldn't have done all the things I've done." I feel the same way. Ken changed his mind when he was 45 years old. He fell in love with a child who, as Ken says, was looking for a father to adopt. Ken and his wife, Gail, adopted Alexander and embraced parenthood. To be clear, therapy wasn't a quick or easy process, but it was effective because I was learning to trust myself. While I was seeing Cecily, I decided to invite my parents to visit us in East Hampton. We had spent time together intermittently over the years, going out for dinner and playing tennis. Jeffrey was a wonderful buffer who kept things pleasant. The weekend of their visit was one of those brutal summer weekends at the store, when I came home exhausted, inert, the worst hostess. I couldn't lift a finger. I didn't cook for them, didn't take them on a tour of East Hampton, nothing. After they left, Jeffrey, who was never critical of me, suggested that maybe I could have been more attentive. He was totally right. I felt terrible when he pointed out that I didn't even buy flowers for the house when they were there. I actually felt so terrible that I invited them back a few weeks later. Flowers for the house. I went crazy and bought huge bouquets for the living room, but that wasn't enough. I dragged enormous clay flower pots home, placed them outside the front door, and filled them with huge purple agapanthus. But that still wasn't enough. Our rental house was in the middle of the woods, so I decided to clear out the brush underneath the trees and plant a flowering shade garden with white astilbe, white Solomon's seal, and purple hostas. And what about trees? Yes, we need flowering trees near the house, I decided. A call to the local nursery took care of that, and a few days later they were planting a grove of beautiful white dogwoods along the driveway. Do you think I overreacted? Maybe, but this was the beginning of my obsession with gardens. I had no idea that I had any interest in them at all, but after that I didn't want to stop. Wait, we were in a rental. I was spending all this time and money landscaping a property that wasn't even mine. I can't imagine what was going through the owner's head, but I hope he was really, really happy, although I'm not so sure the bamboo I planted near the house was such a good idea. More important, I think my subconscious was sending me a message. After so many years of moving from rental to rental, I wanted roots. I loved East Hampton. My business and my friends were all there, and I was staying for good. Jeffrey nailed it when he said it's time to buy a house. This was so much easier said than done. Back from Hong Kong, Jeffrey decided to leave Lehman Brothers and teach at Columbia University while he figured out what to do next. In the meantime, I had fallen in love with a classic shingle-style house in the village of East Hampton that we simply couldn't afford. One day, the seller miraculously lowered the price by 25%, and we swooped in and bought it. Of course, it required a total renovation down to the studs. New kitchen, new bathrooms, new everything. And as with all renovations, the cost just kept going up and up and up until we were literally out of money. Sound familiar? Stop, just stop, I told the contractor. At some point, we'll start again. I promised him and myself optimistically, but I really wasn't sure how. We continued living in our rental while our house, basically a construction site, was on an indefinite pause. Then Jeffrey, who was in New York at the time, called to say he'd been offered a job at Blackstone, a major big-deal boutique investment bank. I speed-dialed the contractor, and by the time Jeffrey got off the train from New York that Friday night, the construction crew was hard at work at the house again, building our dream. We settled into a comfortable routine, back and forth between East Hampton and New York. In 1993, Jeffrey joined the Clinton administration and was appointed Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade, so his commute now stretched from East Hampton to Washington and back each week. By this time, navigating unusual living situations was normal, built into our DNA. We focused on our work when we were apart and on each other when we were together. After several years in our new house, one problem we couldn't seem to solve was the lack of space. It wasn't a big house, and by the time I had renovated it, it had just two bedrooms. Jeffrey needed a home office, but the only place for him to work was the dining room table, right smack in the middle of the house. We couldn't add on because of the property lines. Frank Newbold, our real estate friend, pointed out that there was an empty lot for sale right down the street. Why don't you build the exact same house on that property, and you can add an office to it, he suggested. Weirdly, the idea made perfect sense to me. We could buy the lot, sell our newly renovated house, and build the new one. I couldn't afford an architect, so I designed the house myself, a fabulous, big, fancy, shingle-style house with wraparound porches and lots of bedrooms, including an office for Jeffrey. But wait. I realized that I loved our little house more than the big fancy one I was planning to build. Our street in the village of Hampton was mostly built in the early 1900s with materials that were available at the time, wood shingles, and many houses on the road have the same basic layout, kind of like an early development. I loved it in some part because of the original architecture. Why not be respectful of the community and build to honor what came before us? I tore up my fancy architectural plans and, with a few small additions and changes, built almost exactly the same house that we already owned. I could walk through the rooms blindfolded and know where everything was. Once my living situation was resolved, I needed to figure out my work life. Here's one thing I've learned about myself. I'm an adrenaline junkie. When my work no longer scares me or even challenges me, I get bored. Alarms were going off in my head. Business at the store was terrific, but the truth is the job I had loved for almost 20 years no longer scared me, so I had used a construction project, building a new house, to get that rush. It worked every time. I thought about how I could approach work differently. Managing the store all day and catering several parties at night was becoming mind-numbing, like running on an endless treadmill. I decided that my first move was to stop catering. I did the math. Private parties were taking up 95% of my time, but making up only 5% of my income. Well, that doesn't work. The last party I booked was a friend's wedding, and it was a doozy. There's a British comedy called Noises Off, where Act 1 is a play within the play, perfectly calm and lovely. In Act 2, they turn the stage around and you see the bedlam and chaos going on backstage, people fighting and being pushed on stage. The final act of the play is the original play again, but now you know what's actually going on backstage and it's hilarious. Catering always seemed to me like Noises Off. My goal was always that the client never saw the chaos, only how beautiful their party was. For my last catering job, my friend was marrying a man who owned one of the major English china companies. He asked if he could send all the china for the wedding dinner. Sure, no problem. I just won't order rental plates, I said, not giving it much thought. The day of the wedding started a little crazy anyway. The party was supposed to be outside under the trees on the lawn of a friend's house. Not a good idea, I advised. No tent? What if it's too hot or too cold or worse? What if it rains? My client insisted, so I didn't order a tent. 2 days before, when the forecast predicted rain, I scrambled frantically to find a large tent at the height of the wedding season in the Hamptons. Phew, I found one. Then on the day of the wedding, as people were arriving, it wasn't just raining. It was like someone was throwing buckets of water at the guests. Of course, even the tent couldn't withstand that amount of rain, and it flooded. Now we had to set up a wedding for 150 people inside the house. Isn't catering fun? When I arrived, I saw all the English china piled high in the sunroom in wooden packing crates. It was like walking into the last shot of Raiders of the Lost Ark. There were 150 guests, and each place setting had 5 pieces of china. That's 750 plates and cups individually wrapped with various layers of packing material, including straw and wood excelsior, sealed in wooden crates with nails. This wasn't catering, it was a construction job. The china was the most gorgeous I'd ever seen, hand-painted with lots of gold details. I assumed it was at least $1,000 a plate. I couldn't let anyone else touch it, so I got to work with a hammer, opening crate after crate after crate, trying desperately not to break a single plate, because I actually needed every one. Not to mention that it would cost to replace the broken plate. I just kept saying to myself like a mantra, this is the last party I'm ever doing. This is the last party I'm ever doing, as I pulled nails out with a hammer. Oh yes, did I mention that as people arrived inside the house, a pipe burst on the second floor, pouring water down through the ceiling in the foyer. This is definitely the last party I'm ever doing. It was a relief to stop catering, but I still had to deal with the daily problems, the dramas at the store. Who wants to spend a minute thinking about theft? But that's an unpleasant reality for all retail businesses. Barefoot had shoplifters in all shapes and sizes, from clueless teenagers to the crafty East Hampton matron who rigged her designer purse with a false bottom so she could hide the items she stole. Or worse, the woman, whom I'll call Jane, who simply refused to pay her huge, long-standing bill. One day I decided it was time for a conversation. Jane, I said politely, you need to settle your account. She looked me right in the eye and said, oh, you must be confusing me with someone else. I'm not Jane. At that very moment, one of my salespeople walked by and chirped, hi, Jane. Outed. Instead of being embarrassed, Jane turned on me and said it was my fault that her bill was so big because I kept letting her charge. Then she begrudgingly wrote me a check, a bad check. Moving forward, we got a lot smarter. When customers asked if they could have a house charge, we'd say, of course, we have American Express house charges. Leave your credit card on file and just say charge it at the register. But the all-time prize for outstanding chutzpah went to a brazen thief I stumbled upon in the dark of the night. I was on my way to meet Jeffrey in New York when I decided to make a quick stop at the store. It was after hours, so I unlocked the door and was reaching for the light switch when something caught my eye. 2 huge shopping bags filled with groceries on the counter by the register. 2 pints of ice cream sat on top, so I knew the thief had a key to the store, and he or she would be back soon. Channeling my inner Columbo, I waited, quietly calling Susanna Giuliano, my friend and accountant, to whisper that if someone walked in and killed me, at least I'd be able to tell her who it was. Eventually, the door leading to the offices upstairs, I owned the building and rented to tenants, opened, and in walked one of my tenants. He spotted me in the shadows and coolly admitted that he'd been stealing from Barefoot for years. Why not? Store's overcharged, he said unapologetically. He felt he had a right to steal from them, from me. Was he nuts? It wasn't like he just walked in and swiped something. He had to work for his loot. He had gone into the walk-in refrigerator and taken out a cake, then walked all the way to the bakery, made a box, and found scotch tape to seal it. When he took a bottle of olive oil, he moved all the other bottles on the shelf so it didn't look like anything was missing. I mean, he had gone to an enormous amount of trouble to fill those bags, elevating shoplifting to a new level. And this wasn't his first rodeo. Not that I was giving him any credit. The resolution to this nasty episode was long and complicated and left me disheartened. After 18 years of being in the food business, what I didn't like about running Barefoot Contessa was overshadowing what I used to love. I felt that I wasn't doing anything new, and I certainly wasn't bringing any creativity to my work. I knew the business would suffer if I continued running it on autopilot, and I remembered thinking to myself, I can't tell the employees to close the bathroom door one more time. That's when Susanna and I devised a plan to sell the store. Today, the COVID-19 pandemic has prompted people to question whether their jobs are satisfying and consider quitting and doing something new and exciting. In the 90s, it seemed insane to walk away from the success of Barefoot Contessa, but I was pretty miserable and couldn't see another way. First, I had to figure out how to sell the specialty food store business, which was not an easy thing to do. Without me, Barefoot Contessa wasn't worth that much, especially if the buyer had to hire someone to manage the store, which is what I did. Susanna came up with a brilliant idea. She suggested that I sell the business to Parker, my chef, and Amy, my store manager. I'd finance the sale, and they could pay me from their profits. It was a perfect solution because it presented an exciting path to ownership for them and an effective way out for me. What else could I do, I wondered. What would challenge me? Make me work twice as hard. Keep me up at night solving problems. Cecily had become my dear friend and trusted advisor. She saw that I was struggling for answers and tried to reassure me. She told me that type A people, I guess she was talking about me, can't begin to think about what to do next until they stop what they're doing. They need space and time to allow the universe to reveal what is next. I frankly had no idea what she was talking about, but I trusted her so much that I decided that selling the store and doing nothing for a while was a good idea. Easier said than done. That year turned out to be the hardest year of my life. One day I was running a store with 50 employees and sometimes baking 1,000 baguettes, and the next day I literally had nothing to do. Not a happy place for an adrenaline junkie like me. I took over one of the offices above the store, right next to my old office, and forced myself to go there at 9 a.m. every morning. At first, I was busy with the Barefoot transition, ready to help Parker and Amy any way I could. I still had a financial interest in the store, so I was very present. The internet was a question mark at this point, but I thought it was important for Barefoot to have a website, so I designed one for them as a gift. Who knew that you needed a website? This was 1996, and looking back, I'm proud and a little surprised that I was an early adopter. After that, I had nothing to do. I mean, nothing. I copied over my address book. I read magazines, popped downstairs to Barefoot for a cup of coffee, studied how Warren Buffett invested in the stock market. After a year of investing, I decided I definitely wasn't Warren Buffett and gave that up. I made a business plan for a luxury bus service between the Hamptons and New York City with more amenities than the existing jitney, and looked at real estate investing, my other love beside the food business. I even ran the numbers for buying the A&P and turning the building into a parking lot. Really? Nothing interested me. Nothing got my creative juices going. But instead of giving up and doing something fun like traveling, I kept my office schedule and sat there day after day, bored out of my mind. At this time, Jeffrey was commuting from Connecticut, where he was happily working in his new position as dean of the Yale School of Management. One Monday morning, 9 months into my misery, as he was heading back to New Haven, he asked me what I'd be doing for the rest of the week. I flipped through my calendar. Nothing Monday, nothing Tuesday, but on Wednesday I had a manicure. How sad was that? It was the only thing I had to do all week. A manicure isn't something to do, it's what you squeeze in between appointments, like going to the bank. I knew it was pathetic. What I didn't know was that that's the process. As Cecily suggested, I had to get good and bored. I'd been standing on the side of the pond, looking in, and deciding not to jump in the water. Maybe it's too cold, too deep. Who knows what's in that pond? It was just all too scary. Jeffrey felt terrible watching me suffer and said to me, "You love the food business. Why not think of another way to do it?" I actually had begun to think that my career, the one I had loved, might be over. Maybe this is the end of the line. Maybe I'll never find anything as exciting and as engaging as running Barefoot Contessa. In the meantime, though, I thought, why not just do something, anything, while I figure out what's next? My customers were always telling me I should write a cookbook. I was afraid writing would be a lonely occupation, but at least it was something to do. Maybe, instead of standing on the side of the pond speculating about it, I'll jump in the pond, splash around, and see how it feels. I can sell this book in La Jolla. The first thing I did was to put together a book proposal, thinking no one would ever see it. But I threw myself into the project because that's what I do. It was fun and creative and much better than just sitting in my office. I decided to call it the Barefoot Contessa Cookbook, and it would be the story of the store, including many of the most popular recipes. I got some 8x12-inch whiteboards and cut out photographs from books and magazines that showed how I wanted the book to look. I tested a few recipes, like Perfect Roast Chicken, the outrageous brownies that sold so well, and those coconut cupcakes that no one could resist. And because I didn't know anything about publishing, I asked my friend Lee Bailey, who had a best-selling cookbook, to recommend an editor. She suggested Roy Finnemore at Clarkson Potter, the top editor at the top cookbook publisher in the country. Well, this is never going to happen, I told myself, but I always swing for the fences, so I told my agent to send the proposal to Roy, thinking that would be that. A week later, Roy came back and said, "We will publish your cookbook on the condition that of the 10,000 books we print, you will buy 5,000 of them to sell in your store." Are you kidding? I would have bought all of them and stood on my head for a week if that's what they wanted. And just like that, I had a book contract. Yikes, how is this going to happen? I later found out that Roy sensed that there was a hole in the market and thought the Barefoot Contessa cookbook had all the hallmarks of the food Lee Bailey had made so popular in the 1980s. Simple but elegant, comforting without being boring, and beautifully styled. That was a tremendous compliment because I loved Lee, a real Southern gentleman, and his amazing cookbooks. Later, I also learned that Chip Gibson, the wonderful head of Crown Publishing Group, Clarkson Potter's parent company, had his own reasons for believing in the project. When he was visiting Martha Stewart one summer weekend, she had taken him out for a drive. Suddenly, with a screech of brakes, she swung her giant black Suburban into a death-defying U-turn on Newtown Lane, announcing that she had to stop at Barefoot Contessa to pick up lemon bars. Chip wondered why they were risking their lives for dessert until he tasted them. The memory of that ride and those delicious lemon bars had stayed with him. Chip was always looking for his next bestseller, and when Roy told him about the Barefoot Contessa cookbook, he immediately saw its potential. A collection of uncomplicated but show-stopping recipes that looked pretty easy to make, plus gorgeous party platters built around prepared foods that required no cooking at all. The beginning of store-bought food is fine. And like Roy, Chip sensed that the Hamptons wasn't just a place. It was becoming a state of mind, synonymous with celebrity, luxury, and high-end fun. Its cachet would extend far beyond an East Coast beach. "I can sell this book in La Jolla," Chip thought. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. This has been Margaret with Biographies and Memoirs. I've been reading from the book Be Ready When the Luck Happens, a memoir by Ina Garten, copyright 2024 by Ina Garten. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library.